to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. By this time next week, students will be back at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. The first day of school is Wednesday. Among the security changes, monthly code red drills for students, faculty, and staff. A code red puts the school on lockdown. It's just one of the changes after the February 14th mass shooting. And this week, the school's district's report about the mass shooter was released. The records detail the shooter's years in the school system, his troubles, what the district knew about those troubles, and how it handled them. But the public was not supposed to know most of those details. More than two dozen pages were blacked out in the released report. The district said it was to comply with the education and medical privacy rights of the shooter. But a simple copy and paste allowed those redactions to reappear. So what do the records show? How could they change how the district deals with troubled students? And who's responsible for keeping redactions secret? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is the telephone number to join our conversation. You can also tweet us at WLRN on Twitter as we begin with the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School mass shooting development this week. Also this week, families of students killed in the attack stepped up their criticisms of the Broward School Board and Superintendent Robert Runcie. This is Fred Gutenberg. His daughter, Jamie, was one of those killed in February.
They are unable to make clear, concise direction. They are unable to make decisions that they can agree upon and commit to. They should be fired.
There are five Broward School Board seats up for election this year. Two parents of students killed at Stoneman Douglas are running for those seats. How do those elections stack up? Are you paying attention to the school board election, particularly in Broward County this year? 800-743-WLRN to join the conversation as we begin the Florida Roundup with Brittany Wallman with us from the Sun Sentinel via Skype. Brittany was one of the reporters who was able to report on the details released a week ago from the school district regarding the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooter. Brittany, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
So a week ago, the school district, under the court order, released the report that it asked for from an outside entity to generate based upon the school records of the school shooter. Describe, first of all, the report that you first received.
Well, there were pages and pages and pages of just black boxes. Everything that was about the shooter was redacted, blacked out. And so what remained in the report was very obtuse, general, hard to decipher references to a couple of mistakes that the school district had made in his schooling. But you couldn't really drill down on what they had screwed up because it was all blacked out.
And we will talk about the contents of the report itself in a second, but the process here matters. So what happened next? What did you and your colleague do next with that report?
Well, I was working with Paula McMahon, and we put up a story based on the redacted report. And a couple hours later, someone messaged us on Facebook, just someone that we don't know, not a Facebook friend, and said, "Hey, it's not really redacted. If you just copy and paste it into another file, you'll be able to see everything." And that was really hard to believe. She was standing over my shoulder. We did it. It was no trickery or anything but a simple copy and paste. And voila, the whole thing just pasted in with no blacking out. And she said that she had just searched for the name Nicholas Cruz, and even though it was underneath black, it popped up on it. So we were on deadline. We didn't have a lot of time, and we just scrambled.
And you wrote you did an entire rewrite based upon the unredacted report.
Yes, we that unveiled actually 2/3 of the report, which detailed this very interesting and troubling journey that the shooter had, starting at age 3 through the Broward School District school system. So then you were able to see what they knew when we got to these high school years that were so important.
So describe that journey that the report describes for the shooter.
Well, he was first introduced to the school district by his parents when he was three in pre-K. He already was profoundly troubled. That was one thing that rang clear, was that this was not something that developed in his teen years. He was had already been kicked out of a daycare. He went through a period where he had this very strange animal fantasy where he would pounce on students and scale furniture, and it was distracting to the whole school process. He would have really periods where he did well and he improved, and sometimes teachers would say he was sweet and he tried very hard. And then he always would then plunge backwards and have all kinds of behavioral problems. And so what you see over the period of many years is that he never was able to succeed in a mainstream setting. He thrived the best when he was in a more sheltered special ed setting with a lot of services. And, you know, there was just a lot of wrangling by the school district to try to respond to his roller coaster behavior.
And the response through the years, as you walked through this journey laid out in this report in the last week about the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooter and how the school district handled him through his years in the district. What does that journey look like in terms of the services offered by the school district and the response to the district over the years as this behavior came and went?
Well, the consultant found that, you know, it shouldn't be looked at through the lens of hindsight, where we all know that this is a student who went on to massacre people at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High. So the consultant found that he thought what the school district did was reasonable. But what you did see was that as long as the shooter was cocooned in counseling, and special ed allows you to waiver from some school testing and you get extra time, and there's just a lot of protection involved, that he did okay and he was progressing towards graduation. But when we get to his junior year and this decision to send him to Marjory Stoneman Douglas, you know, they had this gigantic pile of essentially evidence that he never could succeed in a regular school. He ended up being sort of nudged to reject being in special ed. Mm. And so as soon as he was just a regular student without any extra protections from special ed, and then, of course, his mother died, then he was just kind of thrown to the winds and he failed.
Nudged by whom? Does the report show that? Nudged by whom to kind of turn away from some of the alternative education facilities that could have been offered or perhaps were?
Yeah. Well, what happened was they wanted to remove him from Douglas and send him back to the special ed campus. Now,
they being the school district here.
Yes. Yes. And this, yes, because he was, you know, he was having behavioral problems. He didn't understand. He had a history of not understanding vocabulary and complicated things like that. He really just didn't want to leave Douglas. And so, but he was 18, and so it was a big conference. There were special ed people involved. His mother was involved, and they said, you know, if you, you're 18, I mean, they presented the idea to him that he could reject special ed services. They misstated what his rights were. And then when he didn't follow through with actually writing it up, they wrote it up for him, had him sign it, and then he was just treated like a regular person, and he failed miserably, and they kicked him out of the school, and, you know, everything just kind of went downhill from there.
We're speaking with Brittany Wallman via Skype. She is a reporter at the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, one of the two reporters who reported some enterprise reporting on the report from the Broward County Public School District that was released 1 week ago regarding the kind of school journey of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooter. Brittany, you mentioned this report was written by a consultant. Talk to us just kind of how this report itself came about, what its purpose is, and what happens to it now.
Well, the school district engaged this consultant for $60,000 to just look and see how did they break any laws? Did they follow what they were supposed to follow? There's lots of rules and laws surrounding the treatment of a special education child. And they've been saying for months that, we can't answer this about the shooter. Wait till the report comes out. Then we'll all know. And then, of course, when the report came out, it was redacted, but done in such a sloppy manner that they essentially released the whole file. But the public reaction, even though the consultant's sort of spin on it was that the district largely did everything right. The public's reaction has been to latch on to these mistakes that were made because the superintendent has repeatedly said, hey, there's nothing we could do to provide services to the shooter in his final 2 years in school because he rejected services. Mm-hmm. And now we find out from the report that actually that was a mistake on the part of school officials. And so it kind of calls into question whether did the superintendent know that? And if so, why did he say what he said?
So what happens next with this report? Is the school district now compelled to, take under advisement? Does the report include any recommendations or suggestions and policy changes, even as it identifies perhaps a few shortcomings, to put it mildly?
It does. It took a really light touch with the district. There are, pages of recommendations that are very general in nature, saying, that they really need to retrain and reconsider. There was a lot of bureaucracy. And one thing that was revealed was that at one point, Nicholas Cruz decided, hey, wait, I do want to be in special ed. I want to graduate. And they screwed that up. And that's huge. They treated him like he was just a stranger and needed to be reevaluated for the program, even though they had known him since he was three.
Yeah.
So it was that sort of thing, like reconsider whether you need to be so rigid with bureaucracy when you have mounds of evidence that would lead you to the right decision.
Brittany Wallman, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us via Skype. Brittany, thank you for your time and sharing your reporting with us here today on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Now, on Monday, the Broward School Board, the Broward School District, asked a judge to hold Wallman, her colleague, Paula McMahon, and their news organization, The Sentinel, in contempt for publishing the redacted information against a judge's order. By Tuesday, it was clear that the publicly elected school board had not been told of the legal action taken by the school district. The contempt request argues the Sun Sentinel agreed the redacted information was protected by state and federal law, yet decided to publish it anyway. We asked the Broward School District to join us for the Florida Roundup to talk about this. They declined to comment and declined our invitation. So who's responsible for following the judge's order to keep some of the shooter's records secret? And where's the balance of privacy and the public's right to know? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Scott Ponce is along with us, a partner at Holland & Knight. He represents our partner, the Miami Herald, in its case for public records related to the FIU bridge collapse. Scott, welcome to WLRN. Just for clarity's sake, are you playing any legal role in this case with the Sun Sentinel and the Broward School District?
I am not. I have no role in this case.
All right. So walk us through your estimation of what the issues are here.
I would say that there's two issues, Tom. The first is, under the First Amendment, you can't publish a newspaper for publishing what we call lawfully obtained truthful information. So here, the newspaper and the reporters received from the school district a document. They obtained it lawfully, they being the school, the reporters. They obtained it lawfully, it's truthful, and they published it. And under the First Amendment, you can't punish them for doing that. The second notion invoked here with a request to hold someone in contempt of court is that to be in contempt of court, you have to be compelled to do something, or an order has to tell you not to do something, and despite the command of that court order, you do the opposite of it. So here what happens in public records litigation is sometimes a document contains both what we call exempt information, information that's exempt from the public records law, and information that is within the scope of the public records law. And when that happens, the judge will order the government agency, they're the custodian of the record, so the court will order the government agency, say, produce this record, but redact these portions, and the rest of it goes out unredacted.
And the school district had said the redacted portions of this report were kept secret because of educational and medical privacy concerns, both under state law and federal law.
Right, and that may be true, but you know, this happens a lot. It happens sometimes when you have public records litigation, sometimes when it doesn't. But frequently a government agency, not frequently, sometimes a government agency will give journalists documents that the journalists weren't supposed to have. It contains information that's protected under another law. Yep. And you come to the intersection of someone's privacy right versus the First Amendment, and the balance that's been undertaken in that is that if the journalist gets a document lawfully and it's truthful, you can't punish them for publishing it.
Clearly, you are biased in not necessarily this case, but you have stood with media organizations. You are representing the Miami Herald in a Freedom of Information issue with the Florida Department of Transportation as it comes to the Florida International University bridge collapse. I make my living in the media, so let's just put that out there, Scott.
Right.
Where,
fair enough.
I mean, it's clear, obviously, I think, where we would come down on this argument, but the broader issue here is worthwhile, I think, in a discussion in the public here in the Florida Roundup that we're able to do, because you have a very significant government entity in South Florida essentially accusing a major media organization of contempt of court.
It is, and you don't see that a lot. And frankly, I don't know that I've ever seen it before, and it's just...
We should say the judge has yet to grant the request.
Correct.
The contempt
correct.
Request. The judge is still considering it.
Right. And I believe the Sun Sentinel's response is forthcoming. I don't think they've responded to the motion yet. It's just a really weird confluence of technology here in the sense that it was a, I don't know if quirky is the right word, but it was a quirky aspect of this technology that allowed this document, you know, to be, in a sense, unredacted, in the sense that you could copy it from its application and paste it in a different application.
Did you know you could do that?
I had no idea.
I'm sure you've seen reams and reams of redacted government documents in your years.
We do. We've seen lots, and you know, frequently we get them on printed hard copy paper and not in an electronic format that would allow that. And I didn't know this is something that you could do.
And with that in mind, have we entered a new stage of freedom of information intersecting with technology and how government agencies may respond now?
We probably have. I mean, you know, it seems like had these documents been done, what we say, the old-fashioned way,
hard paper,
yeah. And someone taking a sticker and putting it over it, or someone taking another piece of paper, blank paper, and putting it over it, supposed to be redacted, and publishing that, you know, you couldn't have, this wouldn't have happened. So frequently technology outstrips the use it's being used for, yeah. And I think that's what happened here.
There's a lesson as much for media, as much for the public, as it is for government agencies that are dealing with these requests that not just come from the media. They come from – it's the freedom of information that's not exclusively for media and journalists. It is for citizens.
It is. It is. And you know, frequently, most often, we see these public records issues come up because the media is the surrogate for the public. You know, the media is the one that has the funding and the ability and the know-how to get these documents from the public and then from the government and then pass them on to the public. But it is. It's any citizen's right to know. The Florida has a very broad public records law and exists for the benefit and can be invoked by the public, and it's not reserved just for the media.
Scott Ponce, partner at Holland & Knight, representing the Miami Herald, our partner in its case for public records related to the FIU bridge collapse. He is not playing an official legal role in the case of the Broward School District filing a contempt request for the Sun Sentinel. Scott, nice to have you on the program.
Tom, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Walking through these issues with us. We got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Since Parkland, police can now ask a judge to take away someone's guns. How often is it happening, and is it protecting people from danger? 800-743-WLRN. Red flag warnings up next on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The gun legislation passed after the Parkland mass shooting was historic for many reasons, not the least of which was that it represented the first gun restrictions passed in Florida in more than 20 years. Now, one of those changes is what's called red flag warnings. The law allows police to ask a judge for permission to temporarily take away the guns of someone they think is a danger to themselves or others. Critics argue red flag warnings ignore the constitutional rights of people, such as skipping due process. Since March, when the law was signed, police in Broward County have used the red flag warning dozens of times, according to a report this week in the Miami New Times. So how are these warnings being used? Are they being abused by law enforcement officers? Have you or someone you know or a neighbor perhaps been subject to a red flag warning? Do you think someone ought to be subject to a red flag warning? 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number, 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Twitter at WLRN. Jessica Lipscomb, a writer for the Miami New Times, is back with us and the author of this report on red flag warnings in Broward County. Jessica, nice to see you again. Welcome back.
You too. Thank you.
So did I get it right describing red flag warning? Essentially, police officers can go to court and ask a judge, hey, this guy or gal shouldn't have access to firearms.
That's right. So typically this happens when a family member or someone close to the person thought to be a danger calls police and says, hey, something's not right with this guy. We don't think he should have a gun. Police then do their own investigation, and depending on what they find, would file a petition with the judge in whatever county they're in, and the judge would make the ultimate ruling.
So what's important here, among many things, is it's not the family member or the neighbor that can make the request. It has to go through a law enforcement officer to the court.
Right. Some states do allow family members to make the petition, but in Florida, it has to go through a law enforcement agency.
And this request can affect what? Just those people who have who actually have a firearm or firearms, or can it actually stop somebody from purchasing a firearm if they don't have one already or want to go out and buy one?
So it goes both ways. So you do have people that have weapons already that this law would help take them away. But it also, if somebody, you know, is making plans for a shooting, say, or making suicidal threats, that you could prevent them from buying future guns or possessing them.
So this came into effect in mid-March, and you looked at several months worth of records in Broward County. What did you find?
So in Broward County, which apparently is the county with the most petitions filed, they had 108 through the end of July, which is a pretty significant number. And we had 28 cases where the person was accused of domestic violence, 45 people who were suffering from mental illness, and 34 people who were contemplating suicide.
How does this red flag warning differ from what we call the Baker Act, which is the ability of someone to be committed for a short finite period of time for evaluation?
So in some cases, these petitions do arise after someone is Baker acted, but it gives the courts the ability to take someone's guns for a longer period of time, for up to 1 year. How it worked before this law passed was that if you were Baker acted, there wasn't really a lot in the law that it's talked about how you should get your guns back if the police seized them from you. It was sort of a gray area. So some police departments would take them, and then you might have to take them to court to get your guns back. But this just formalizes it.
It formalizes it. It's temporary, however, correct?
It goes up to 1 year, and then at the end of that year period, it goes back before the judge, and the judge can either decide to give that person their guns back or to keep them for another year.
Is that first period of 1 year set, or is that discretionary? Can the judge decide, well, it's going to be a couple of weeks for this person, but maybe a year for this other person?
It's up to 1 year, so I guess it could be under that. But in all the cases I saw, they were always for 1 year.
They went for 1 year. Mm-hmm. So we haven't obviously cycled back around to that 1 year to see how those cases are going to make themselves. How is someone to defend him or herself if they think they've been unfairly targeted by a red flag warning?
So everyone, when this happens temporarily, the police will come once they get a judge to sign off on the temporary order and come take your guns. And then after 14 days, it goes to a hearing. And that's when you can make your case to the judge as to why you think you should be able to keep your gun. Now, unlike criminal cases, there's no lawyer appointed for somebody who can't afford one. So that's one criticism that some people have of the law, is that people who don't have the ability to pay for their own lawyer will have to represent themselves.
Is that the due process criticism among others, as well as that 14-day stretch that that somebody could be without their firearm under this red flag warning?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a fear that, you know, since a lot of these cases do target people with mental illness, you're essentially asking a mentally ill person to represent or to make their own case to the judge.
We're talking with Jessica Lipscomb, writer for the Miami New Times. She wrote about the red flag warnings and how they have been handled in Broward County since the signing of the gun restriction law passed in the aftermath of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school massacre in February, finding more than 100 red flag warnings have been used by Broward County law enforcement officers. Have you or someone you know been issued one of these red flag warnings? Do you know somebody, perhaps, that ought to be subject to a red flag warning? What about the balance between the Second and the Fourth Amendment? It's a constitutional question. It is a public safety question here in Florida. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jessica, you pored over these dozens and dozens of cases. What were some of the more egregious or some of the more compelling ones where law enforcement was clearly and immediately concerned, maybe in regards to public safety?
There were several cases, actually, I think up to six, where people had mentioned wanting to shoot up a school, which was pretty concerning, obviously, after Parkland. There was one case where a white man attacked some black construction workers and shouted racial slurs at them and phrases like white power, somebody that probably shouldn't have a gun. There was another man who was planning on shooting his wife and the pastor at church one day, and he made a public confession about wanting to do that, and guns were also taken away from him.
And in those instances, were those individuals found with firearms on their person, or was it a matter of access to firearms?
The cases varied. I would say the majority of the cases that were filed did involve people that already had guns or had there was one case, actually, where someone was planning on buying one at Dick's and they were waiting for the 3-day
waiting period. The sporting goods store, right, yeah.
But in some cases, actually, and especially a couple of the potential school shooter cases, those involved children that didn't necessarily have guns, but it was trying to stop them from ever getting their hands on them.
You also detailed the story of a court officer, I believe, in Broward County. A bailiff, is that right?
Right, yeah. One of the court bailiffs, this was actually a case that did get a little bit of media attention, but he was making comments about wanting to shoot people at the courthouse, apparently putting his hands in a gun shape and firing down from the atrium. So they took 67 guns from his house after that.
Yeah, so walk us through what the record showed in that particular case. It struck me in your reporting that was a case where it wasn't just one or two guns that the individual had access to, dozens in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's important to note that the court bailiffs aren't armed in the course of their job at the Broward County Courthouse.
They don't carry a sidearm.
Right, yeah. But he was making comments to several of his coworkers about how people at the courthouse would be easy prey, kind of mumbling comments about wanting to shoot people, and he had purchased an increasingly large number of firearms in recent months, so the courts ultimately decided that he shouldn't have access to those.
As you walked through the records of these red flag warnings, what did you see in terms of the subject to the warnings? Did they go after this 14-day period for a court hearing and defend their right to have a firearm? And were they successful in retaining them or having them returned to them?
So just looking at the court docket, it's hard to tell if people actually were showing up to those hearings to fight against it. But I did find in 13 cases, I believe, people did hire a lawyer to help challenge it. And obviously the people that had lawyers were more successful in getting the cases dismissed against them.
And so what happens in those cases? It's just an immediate return. In that case, they could leave the hearing and go to a gun shop and purchase a gun lawfully.
Right. And the judge would essentially sign an order giving their guns back, because in all of these cases, the guns were taken away on a temporary basis.
And was there a commonality in the grounds for returning them after that red flag warning in those cases?
There didn't seem to be. I would say, again, people...
Each case is going to be on its own merit before the law students and the legal scholars call us. We know that. But just wondering if there's a commonality.
Yeah. So the judges actually granted about 3/4 of the cases. The ones that were dismissed tended to be people with lawyers, or there were a couple of cases where people, you know, were making thoughts of suicide, but it wasn't thought to be a specific you know, they didn't plan to make an attempt or something like that.
As I mentioned, the law that was passed in the wake of the Parkland tragedy was historic in Florida, which has been a gun-friendly state for a number of years. Raising the age to purchase rifles and long guns has been targeted by the National Rifle Association and other gun supporters as unconstitutional. And they've filed lawsuit over that, and that lawsuit is making its way. Has this found, has the red flag warning provisions also found itself subject to this kind of constitutional challenge?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I did reach out to the NRA on several occasions, and they refused to get back to me and make a public comment
about
this.
Didn't talk to you at all.
Right. They did make a statement after the shooting in February that they supported these kinds of laws, but then in the months afterwards, they fought against them as states tried to pass them. So it's a little bit of a trick question.
How unique is this red flag warning in terms of other state laws outside of Florida?
Before the Parkland shooting, there were only 5 states that had this law. Florida was the first, obviously, after the Stoneman Douglas shooting to enact this kind of law, and other states followed. I'm not sure exactly how many, but probably a dozen others.
So this law, this portion of the law, does not currently have any kind of legal challenge against it?
Not to my knowledge.
Fair to say? Okay. Mm-hmm. And as you talk to the legal community about the use of this in your reporting, what was the general reaction?
Well, there's one lawyer in Orlando who's fought against cases up there in Orange County and also in Broward, who says that this law can kind of stigmatize people. If people are publicly made out to be a dangerous person, that could affect someone's employment, mm-hmm. Their ability to make an income, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but do you see that as a direct criticism of the warning, of the outcome of the warning, or the process of the warning, or just simply the identification of somebody?
I mean, I think, you have to be a little careful when you're, essentially, if you're taking someone's guns away with this order, you're saying that they can't be trusted with a weapon, which I think is, for some people, especially in the gun community, that can be a scarlet letter of sorts.
Sure, yeah. Jessica Lipscomb, writer and reporter for the Miami Dune Times, writing about red flag warnings and their use in Broward County since the new gun restriction law after Parkland was put in place in March. Jessica, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here in the Rondo. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We got plenty more to come here. Stick with us. A presidential assassination attempt in Venezuela and the claims of a Miami connection. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Saturday afternoon, as Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was speaking at a large military ceremony in Caracas, 2 drones with 4 pounds of C4 plastic explosives between them exploded. Maduro was unharmed. The regime has arrested at least a half dozen people, including 2 opposition lawmakers since then, and it says a Miamian financed the attack. Meantime, Florida Governor Rick Scott was in Colombia this week, where he met with Venezuelan opposition leaders in exile. So this is up next here on the Florida Roundup. Your thoughts on the reported attempt on the life of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, the Venezuelan claims of a South Florida connection, and Florida's governor and U.S. Senate candidate traveling to Colombia to meet with Venezuelan political opposition leaders there. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is our telephone number. Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's correspondent, is with us. And Andrew Rosati is a journalist covering Venezuela for Bloomberg News with us on the telephone from Caracas. Andrew, let's start with you. Describe, I guess, the latest that you can share with us regarding the assassination attempt, and perhaps most importantly, the Maduro regime's response here late in the week.
Well, initially there was a lot of confusion around this event. Some people and some outlets suggested that this may have been a gas explosion of sorts. But speaking to witnesses on the ground, there was indeed an attack. One of the drones swerved off into a residential building, setting it ablaze and injuring a number of civilians. I spoke with residents there, and they definitely confirmed a unmanned flying object, and it did go off and exploded there. And others close to the military parade where this happened, spoke of sniper rifles going off and bringing down this second drone that you can see the president and the first lady looking at in the air. Since then, you know, the government has launched a crackdown of sorts. They say they have tied 19 different people to this attack. Most noteworthy, if you would be the a young congressman, Juan Requesens. He was detained early this week. Security footage, you know, shows intelligence police tackling him inside his apartment building. He and his sister were both arrested. His sister is a student leader, and she was since released. Requesens is currently behind bars, we are told. The other person they have implicated is Julio Borges. He was the former head of the opposition-controlled Congress. He fled the country preemptively earlier this year. He's in Bogota and has denounced this, saying this is, you know, another excuse by the regime to crack down on its opponents. The government has indicated that more arrests could come. They have not indicated who that would be, but we're waiting to see. Things like this have happened in the past, and you know they have rounded up many of their opponents.
Tim, what have we heard from the Venezuelan community here in Miami regarding this?
The Venezuelan community here has been fairly quiet, and I think for good reason. They're very torn between obviously wanting to see this disastrous dictatorial socialist regime in Venezuela eventually fall. But by the same token, I think most of them do realize here that it doesn't really help their cause to have that cause associated with this kind of violent militancy that we saw not only on Saturday, but we also saw last year when another member of this group known as La Resistencia, that's taking responsibility for it, you know, commandeered a police helicopter and buzzed the presidential palace, you'll remember, and dropped stun grenades, etc. So I think there's a certain reticence on the part of the expat community here because they know that it really doesn't help their cause in the end to be associated with, you know, these sort of violent extra-legal schemes to bring down the regime, because they know that that's not going to get much support in the international community.
Andrew, what about a more broader and general kind of crackdown or response from the regime? We've seen that oftentimes when you've seen the Maduro regime challenged, both you know, in the streets and elsewhere, where there tends to be a pretty significant response by the regime. Is that your sense here this time, or for whatever reason, does it seem to be a bit more targeted, maybe?
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. Well, what I can tell you is happening on the ground. Currently, conditions are much worse than they were last year when the protests were in their height, and as much as 1 million people came out on the streets of Caracas at different points in the protests last year.
Much worse now, how, you know, Andrew? Much worse how? You mean the economic situation?
The economic situation, the infrastructure situation, we're experiencing constant water cuts throughout Caracas. The lights are going out occasionally in specific neighborhoods. You know, inflation is projected to reach 1,000,000% this year, according to the IMF. So we are seeing protests starting to simmer again on the ground. They are not directed by the opposition per se. They're more spontaneous. They're people demanding higher wages. They're demanding better services. And, you know, in these recent weeks, we've been seeing a number of lawmakers trying to give some direct political direction to that. I would say that many Venezuelans are on the ground, I think, are fed up with the politicians on both sides of the divide after last year, because again, things have gotten worse. They haven't gotten better. They haven't seen any change by anyone that promised change last year. And it's interesting in the sense that, as well, that one of the lawmakers that was trying to bring was rallying the health sector. He fled the country last month. He had been telling health workers, nurses specifically, to protest their low wages. He claimed that security forces had sent threats against his family, and he fled to Colombia. Now, Juan Requesens, the young congressman that was detained, he had promised to bring protests back to the streets. He had said that he was not going to stand down, and he was known, especially in 2014, for his street demonstrations. So there is a sense that these are targeted. These are, as again, these protests are starting to simmer again. They're nothing like last year, but they're people are very, very upset about the finance, about the economic and living standards here in Caracas. They're not good.
Tim, before we explore kind of that Miami and South Florida reaction to the worsening economic crisis, it is not just a situation, it's a crisis, certainly in Venezuela. The Maduro regime has made claims of a South Florida connection to this assassination attempt.
Yeah. There's a gentleman that they've fingered named Osman Delgado. And he's the son of a fairly wealthy business family, as we understand it, in Carabobo State. Is that correct, Andy? He was also accused last year of helping to finance a sort of short-lived uprising by rebel soldiers at a military base there in Carabobo State that was put down immediately. So they're accusing him again of having helped finance this drone assault. Very little is known about him here, and you can find very few Venezuelan expats who actually know the guy's name, let alone where he is or who might be representing him legally, etc. It's very shadowy. But, you know, in any exile or expat community like this, you are obviously going to have more militant figures like this. I mean, the Cuban-American community had many of them for decades.
And Andy, I ask about that question here, obviously, because of the large population here in South Florida with significant ties to Venezuela, and a lot of those ties are increasingly being relied on to help subsidize and support the tragic economic consequences of the Maduro regime. When the administration in Venezuela makes these claims about a South Florida connection, what is the response? What's the kind of the general, I guess, reaction among those on the streets of Caracas?
I think it should be made clear that there is a huge amount of confusion. There's a lot of disinformation, and most Venezuelans I speak with are coping with the daily grind here. The Venezuelan government has repeatedly made claims in the past that it's discovered assassination attempts, that there is plots to undermine the Maduro administration. Now, there is some truth to that. In Bloomberg, we have reported about a failed coup attempt earlier this year. There are, and again, as Tim brought up earlier, there was a rogue helicopter pilot that lobbed grenades and fired live rounds at government ministries last year. There are real attacks that happened here, but this is a very familiar line that many Venezuelans have heard and often used in a context to blame the government, the financial and economic woes on these accused, terrorists and coup plotters. So, on the ground, I'm off, most people I talk to, take it in stride, and they're not really paying that close attention. I think it was really interesting to me that I talked to, whether taxi drivers or health sector workers, and many people were doubting both the opposition and the government when this first happened. And when I went and spoke to witnesses on the ground, they were immediately saying, well, actually, there's a building on fire in front of my house last night. I saw my neighbors being taken out by health workers. So this was a very very real thing that happened here.
Yeah, Andy's right. I mean, it took a full 24 hours, really, for I think a lot of Venezuelans to accept the government's claim that there even had been a drone attack until videos came out that were very closely examined. And it did show that the claim was credible. But at the same token, I mean, Andy's right. I mean, one of the reasons for all that doubt is because the Maduro and the socialist regime are so shamelessly notorious for concocting conspiracies. And we should also point out that, blaming South Florida is straight out of the communist Cuban regime playbook. When in doubt, blame the expats in South Florida, be it Cubans or in this case the Venezuelans, because that's just a fantastic way to divert attention away from your own screw-ups, which in Venezuela are epic.
Has there been any meaningful response from the Trump administration or the State Department?
No. The Trump administration also is just calling the fact that Maduro is blaming Washington, and not just Washington. We should point out his most direct accusation, Maduro's most direct accusation, was against Juan Manuel Santos, the president of Colombia, who just left office last week, to which, Santos, I think, rightly just scoffed.
Which brings us to state politics, and Governor Rick Scott, running for the U.S. Senate this week, spent the first part of the week in Colombia doing a number of different things, including meeting with Venezuelan opposition leaders in Colombia in exile. Tim, what do you make of this kind of trip with the head of state and state government playing a little bit of foreign relations?
No. Rick Scott, I mean, this is part of really his campaign playbook this year. I mean, he has really gone out, whether it's Puerto Ricans, Venezuelans, Cubans, etc. He realizes that in this election, his campaign against Bill Nelson, that the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, is going to be a very important swing vote, particularly Puerto Ricans, which is why he has gone out.
Just a week or two he was in Puerto Rico.
Exactly. This is why he's gone out of his way, for example, to really help Puerto Ricans as they've come escaping Hurricane Maria.
Has he done the same for Venezuela, though, over the past several years with this, what had been a slow-moving erosion, which has picked up steam in terms of the bottom falling out of the economy?
The problem is there's very little that a state governor can do for expats in Venezuelan situation. I mean, he can promise them that, I'm going to try to make sure that Florida doesn't do business with firms that do business with the Venezuelan regime. However, our friend Steve Bousquet this week had a report out showing that in his blind trust, he's actually got investments, unfortunately, in companies like Goldman Sachs that are still doing direct business with the Venezuelan regime. That may have made things a little uncomfortable in Bogota when he was meeting with the Venezuelan expat leaders.
What can come out of that kind of meeting?
Nothing more than symbolism. Really, it shows that he cares. It shows that he cares to the Venezuelan expat community here, which obviously is going to have fewer voters, in the mix in November than, say, Puerto Ricans.
Sure.
But it shows the broader Latino community that he does care about their issues, and that resonates with all kinds of Hispanic voters here.
Hey, Andrew Rosati, who reports for Bloomberg in Caracas, is still with us. I want to ask you, Andrew, just in our final moments here, about the broader hemispheric response to the news out of Venezuela over the past week or so. I know you're in Caracas, but have you gotten a sense of a Colombian response, an Argentinian response throughout the hemisphere there?
Again, this has been a line often used by the government in the past to explain why things aren't working the way they should. Like to try and cast the blame on things like hyperinflation, the lack of basic foods and medicines. So I think there was initial hesitation by a lot of actors in the region to see if there was some truth to this. The government immediately blamed former Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos as the culprit,
right.
And the Colombian government denounced this immediately. It was in his final days of an office. And, I think moving forward, the government has said here that they're going to seek extradition so much from Colombia and the U.S. The response that I've seen throughout the region has been somewhat muted, given the government's track record.
We've got to leave it there. Andrew Rosati, Bloomberg journalist, with us via telephone from Caracas. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. We'll end on a lighter note in a moment, but Tim and Andrew, thank you for your time.
Thank
today.
You.
Much appreciated. Finally on the roundup this week, in Miami, it seems challenging enough to get some drivers to use their turn signals, but ask them to drive on the opposite side of the road to navigate a new traffic pattern? Well, we'll find out how well that works in the week ahead. It's the plan beginning Monday at Northwest 27th and the Dolphin. It's called a Diverging Diamond Interchange, or DDI in the language of traffic engineers, and in a video produced by the Miami Expressway Authority to explain to drivers how it will work.
A DDI works by temporarily shifting traffic in both directions to the left or opposite side of the road.
So the idea is to make it easier for drivers entering and exiting the Dolphin Expressway without having to cross over traffic lanes by having the traffic drive on the opposite side of the road. Now, when Springfield, Missouri put in a DDI, a study there found crashes were reduced by 60%. But of course, Missouri is not Miami. In Missouri, drivers tend to use turn signals and turn them off.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Our program is produced each week by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. And WLRN's director of radio programming and our technical supervisor on this program is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio.